If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 571. Men Need Not Apply. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Saturday, May 8th, 2021. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded a few weeks ago with First of Incelmatics. First was here on the podcast about a year ago, I think. And he and I rendezvoused on Zoom to talk about this blog post that he sent me like a month and a half ago now, and the recording to that conversation has gone AWOL. So he kindly reconvened with me, and we did the conversation you're about to hear is the first hour of a 3-hour live stream that we did together for his channel, Incelmatics, on YouTube. So if by the end of this you want more, well, I'll post a link to it in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on crealm.com. But to get us started, the blog post that he originally sent to me and which was the basis for our conversation is on a blog called Face to Face, or, you know, the URL is Aki no Kure, which is Japanese for face to face, .blogspot.com. And if you don't know how to spell Aki no Kure, well, I'll post a link to it in the show notes for this episode. But you could probably find it just by doing a search for Subcultures Are Dead. And the full title of this blog post, and this is from February 27th, 2021 on the Face-to-Face blog, Subcultures Are Dead as Straight Guys Drop Out and Cocoon Online After the Great Financial Crisis. And it begins as follows. What really stands out about the so-called subcultures today is the total absence of guys in general, and straight guys specifically. It's 99% girls, whether straight, bi, lesbian, or otherwise. There are a few token gay guys and trannies, but even those demos are mostly absent. Actual straight guys, though, have totally checked out of subcultural communities. It's revealing that the labels for today's main subcultures contain the word girls, e-girls, and alt-girls. That's no accident. There's no such thing as e-boys or alt-boys. Before, subcultures had gender-neutral names because their membership included both in roughly equal numbers. Scene, emo, goth, grunge, punk, wave, new wave, metal, disco, etc. So I won't read any further. I think you get the gist of it there. I mean, from the headline in particular, straight guys just aren't going out into the world and engaging with women. They are staying home, and they're living their lives online, you know, such as they are. So that's the seed of the conversation that you're about to hear with First.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
So I sent you this because it seemed to be out of the ordinary for kind of to cover at this point of the game. You kind of being going from the doomer sphere to kind of like the, I guess, like just political reality kind of sphere, everything results based. That I seem to be going on as well. But yeah, and I think you've covered many different countercultures on your podcast throughout the years. So this is just, the thing is, the author, I think he's a boomer male, if, you know, by reading, it's kind of hard to find, but if you click around on different articles that he's posted previously, you are able to find kind of the clues. Because you said you saw one of his recent articles.
Yeah, I'm on his blog, and before we started talking, I was reading his most recent articles, which are all about mask wearing. But, you know, he talks about, and even in this Subcultures Are Dead piece, you know, he's talking as if he has firsthand experience with subcultures from the aughts and the 90s and even the 80s, and he'd have to be at least my age to, you know, to have been a participant in subcultures from the 80s, you know, to know anything about you know, grunge or punk. I mean, punk is even a little before my time. So I don't know how seriously to take this guy. Like, he also toots his own horn a lot about how good looking he is. And, you know, how he's out in the world with cute girls coming up to him, like in you know, secondhand shops, and women coming and displaying themselves for him. I just don't know how seriously to take all this.
Yeah. So recently I was, BuzzFeed's not a good source, but I guess it's a good source just to hear like someone going through the internet and seeing what people say. So there was a viral Reddit for the day thread, and it asked teachers, do you see any subcultures? What are the subcultures in your classrooms? And a lot of teachers didn't have much to say, but there was some prevalent ones. There was some, like, there was K-pop. There was the stonks, which is just guys that go out at lunch and like discuss stocks and stuff like that, and cryptocurrencies, which is funny for kids that are elementary, middle school age. And then everyone they talked about, it was either, no, there's not nothing really going on, or there's like the typical gamer one, or it's everything they talked about was very gender segregated. And when I sent you this, I said, I have a different idea as to why there's no straight males in the subcultures nowadays. And the ones he discusses was like e-girls, LGBTQ is probably the biggest one. And you can't be a straight male really there, unless if you are, you're called an ally. So you're not part of the clique. You're just, you're already casted out. So yeah, there is... The subcultures that exist today is the guy that's writing this. His observation is completely correct, in my view, is that the ones that exist today, they're not organic, I wouldn't say. They're very product-based. Like, we no longer have real communities. We have, like, the Star Wars community. Then we have, like, maybe you have a baseball community. Like, it's all very... It depends on a larger market. So it's very... Every single one is the consumerist. And people will get into ideological fights on the internet over these ideological, like, over their consumerist brand. The most infamous one was probably back in the PS3, Xbox days. Like, on the internet, there was large flame. And then you have the Apple versus Samsung. You have all these things. People standing behind their product. That's their new identity.
A longstanding variation on that is one you'll find in rural America. It's the Ford versus Chevy pickup truck dynamic. Like, I drove an old Ford Ranger for years, and it was giving me trouble at one point, and somebody looked at it and said, well, I see what's wrong with it. It's the blue oval on the front, you know, which is to say the Ford badge or logo. She thought she was being funny.
Yeah, so getting into the meat of the article, it is very true. The current cultures I see today, you know, his arguments that, and it's like many arguments in the media as to why men aren't in the labor force, men are participating in greater culture, men are dropping out of college at greater rates. 70% of valedictorians in high school are now girls, and that can even increase. I mean, that was an old stat that was talked about by Andrew Yang and on one of his podcasts that he does. And even Andrew Yang on one of his podcasts had a thing, I forgot what the guy that he interviewed, but he talked about, you know, men falling behind, young men falling behind on every front. And that is particularly true today. And they're not only falling out of financial achievements, academic achievements, they're falling out of even like cultural achievements, where that thing shouldn't matter, right? The hippies, it was anti-consumerist supposedly at the start, you know, same with like grunge and, you know, punk, all that type of stuff. But now, you can't even participate the subcultures as a, you know, as a straight young male. And that is particularly true. But what face to face argues is that it's a result of just laziness, of kind of like malaise. It's not induced by anything else. And you know, to me, it's he has the observations correct 100%. But to me, young men have been pushed out of even participating in subcultures. And, you know, these subcultures mainly exist online to this day. You could go Twitter, you know, anywhere. And yeah, it is obvious. And they're very gender segregated, too. And, you know, the importance of this, why, like, I brought it up to you, is because we know the mechanisms the elite is using to distract the mass of the working class from getting together. And when you have older generations talk about kind of like the issues of today, they talk it from a different perspective than a young man would see himself in that story. So kind of like the most stories, if you watch like Richard Wolff on the left, or you watch like a guy like George Gammon on the right, they're both like, they both do economic shows. what's the message there? It's the antagonism between the top and the bottom, right? The top 1%, you know, versus the 99%. That's kind of evident both in left and right economic spheres. You know, they have different, you know, they have different reasons as to why. In almost any, and then you have the blue and red tribers, and then their antagonist is the, like, the politicians of the other tribe. You know, if a red triber is the president, the blue will divert their attention onto, you know, smearing him. And then as soon as a blue tribe president gets in, the red tribe will focus their attention, their media, everything on smearing him. So that's kind of like the two things going on in, like, contemporary, I guess, politic discussion, like legacy. But for the Zoomers and the late millennials, what I see is that there's a big gender war. There's a big gender war. There's a big gender divide. And what better thing for the elites to have? Like, race is one thing, but a complete gender war, that's a more balanced population. That's like, that can go on forever. That's like the perfect formula to keep like a working class distracted and divided.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Let me read something from this blog. Three short paragraphs here. He writes, female sexuality is more malleable than male sexuality, so perhaps the drying up of guys who are willing to show up has led to a lot of girls to adapt their attraction to those who actually do show up, namely their fellow girls. You don't get rewarded for hiding yourself, ignoring the opposite sex, and taking zero risks, insulated by porn girls who trick you into thinking you've already got sexual options. It's their fellow girls who are willing to put themselves out there, take the risk of rejection, and show some attention to the other attendees of public spaces. Then it's their fellow girls who will get the reward. So, you know, what he's saying here is that women are actually participating in these subcultures out in the real world, and guys are just staying home and staying online. Does that ring true to you? I mean, do you agree with that observation?
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's 100% observation. But the thing is that you can't show up as an unannounced young guy. You cannot break into these circles because women hold all the power in now the online social media sphere. They hold all the power. They hold all. They're most of the influencers. They're the people who have the most interactions. That is likes, shares, replies, comments. I mean, there's many memes, like a guy's Facebook page versus a girl's, and it shows like one notification for the guy versus the girl. It's like, you know, 50 friend requests, 100 messages, stuff like that. So there's a great divide on social attention. So it goes down to the woman to kind of invite these males in. You cannot just show up unannounced. You cannot break yourself in. That's harassment. That's the thing, is that that's why I say we young men as a whole have been casted out of these groups. They do not hold any of the power. Like, if we had a patriarchy back in the day, now it's just switched. It's online in the social media sphere. I'm not talking about the real world. That's, the real world is debatable, except now it's becoming not. But it is a young woman's game, due to just our innate biology. You know, a woman's worth way more, and she gets a lot more eyes. You know, and it's a visual platform, all of these. So yeah, so it's, so that's why in the real world, it's what we see is it's the woman kind of choose the men they want them to be around, you know, and they don't choose many men. They choose, you know, it's kind of like the Pareto principle. It's, you know, I'm not saying it's exactly this, but it's the 20% of men getting 80% of the action. It's a very disbalanced system. It's a very polygynous system, which there's evidence that that's how humanity pre-civilization came about. And I'm going to put up what I did is after you covered this, you know, you gave your opinion, you gave what you thought about this on the C-Realm, and then you did it partly on the live stream too. I connected this guy's observation to the data we have, like, you know, mass data. And this is from the Intelligence article, is men and women have never been more politically divided, if you want to go on that one. And that's some very interesting graphs.
Yeah, you know, I live in Vermont because I moved here, you know, with a woman. I was living with her in New York City, and she sold her apartment to come here, and, you know, lock in the gains of the increased price of the real estate, you know, the value of the condo, and turn it into a house here in Vermont. And then we got here and then broke up. So, you know, I live in an apartment by myself here. Not a place I was really ever, you know, ambitious to move to, but here I am. And we had opposite politics from the beginning, really. It's just that in a new romance, you're willing to set all that stuff aside. But then, you know, when the newness of it wears off, well, then it comes to the fore. And in New York City, you know, it's a very liberal place, but even so, I could find, like, we went to parties and I could find people that I could talk to. But here in Vermont, it's a much older sort of hippie liberal crowd here in Vermont. And I really don't click with them at all. But the other faction here, you know, the uneducated, blue collar, you know, young men who define their self-worth, I think, through the amount of noise they can coax out of their vehicles. And there's just active, you know, hostility when I pass those guys on the street. I mean, particularly if I open my mouth and I say something, you know, that clearly identifies me as having, you know, the diction of an educated person. Man, I'm suddenly, you know, they just stare daggers at me. They, you know, it's like they would like to see me dead. So I'm looking to get out of this place. But, you know, all of the cultural hostilities that I've, you know, I've been aware of them for a while, they are really cranked up right now. So I'm not, you know, a witness to the scene, you know, the interactions between young men and women in their 20s. I don't have any around me, except for Colin. But I'm sure it's intense right now because everything's intense.
That's funny you say there's none around you, is because America is facing its own demographic challenges. I mean, there's not enough of young men and women born. And, you know, COVID has turned, you know, this situation to complete baby bust. That doesn't seem to be, because the same people who said this is going to recover said there's going to be a baby boom because they're outdated. They're boomers. I say it's not an age, it's in our community, it's kind of a mindset. You could be a 25-year-old guy and if you espouse old ideas like, oh, just, you know, go to the steel mill and shake the manager's hand and you'll have a house and two cars in 2 years.
No, dude, the steel mill is in China.
Exactly. So
the thing is that the same people who espouse the idea that our current situation would cause a huge baby boom because people are locked up inside, it's like, well, people have to be coupled in the first place, and a lot of men can't get coupled at all. So that's the situation you have. If man can't get a text back, then how are they supposed to have a baby? And what happened is, you know, they were completely wrong. There's a complete and utter baby bust. So they were predicting, you know, 500,000 increase in births, and it's actually like more than 500,000 decrease. Or it's even more now because this situation keeps going on. And they say, oh, don't worry, it's going to recover. And, you know, I say no. I say that's going to be the new trend of demographic decline. And you're going to have situations like you say where in your locality, you're not going to find young people. And we're already seeing that in America. I mean, we have to import a lot of young people anyways through the college system just to keep that afloat. So America's demographic situation is a pretty bad one. If you take away the immigration, it would be a very terrible one. And, you know, that goes back to the situation with men and women. If they can't pair up, you're not going to have a young population to grow out of that, no matter economics aside, job market aside, even housing market aside. And all those are working against us anyways. But yeah, that's the thing. That's another problem you bring up, is that there is going to be a lack of young people. There already really is. I mean, most of this country is kind of like dominated by a boomer population. Gen Z is relatively small because it's mostly kids of the Gen Xers, which is a smaller generation itself than even millennials. And millennials don't seem to be having kids or getting married. So yeah, that with the situation you find yourself in and you're trying to leave, you know, I find myself in too, besides like a social circle from high school and college, and many do. It's kind of like the book we talked about in the podcast, Bowling Alone, which you said there's an update to it, which I'll have to check out. It's a case study of bowling leagues. I think it's Robert Putnam. Yeah, basically the disappearance of bowling leagues, and that's kind of like the stage for it, but there's many other things. There's church activity. There's all these. And so what happened is that social circles have not disappeared. subcultures have not entirely disappeared. It's gone online. You know, it's just gone online. And online, there's a different power dynamic between the genders. Women hold all the power. And we have hard metrics for this. When you make a fresh profile as a woman online, you get hit up by so many men. And not only men, you know, as the article points out, as the face-to-face blog points out, is that the women are malleable in their sexuality to kind of date other women. That's completely true. Gen Z women, I have a, in the Intelligencer article, there's a, at the near bottom, there's a blue and orange dotted chart. And it shows the blue dots are the straight males from 18 to 88. And then the orange is straight females, 18 to 88. And look what happens at 28 to 18. There's a precipitous drop in straight women. It's extreme. It goes from 85 to 65%. We're living in an age now where only 65% of women would identify as straight. While for men, it's kind of steady. It's at 85. It's not jumped so much. There's not such a... The delta wouldn't be as high. You know, the delta for, you know, the straight female decrease is very high. So putting the observation to political reality, yeah, his observation is completely correct. It's just that the media will spin, they will spin different narratives to say why this is happening. You know, just like anything that happens with the labor market, any political event, you know, we see the same thing, but the interpretations can just greatly be different. And I don't know if you want to comment anything on this.
Well, my comment was really a question, I guess, to you. The Aki no Kure, or face-to-face blogger, I think he goes by agnostic is what he calls himself in the comments. You know, agnostic explanation for this is that young men are basically cocooning at home, online, I think because they're still in shell shock from the economic fallout of the 2008 housing crash, which seems pretty remote. I mean, if you're 20 years old, that was 12 years ago or more. No, it's going like 14 years ago. You were just a kid then. So that seems like a pretty distant event at this point.
Yeah, and it's not relevant because you have to be in the housing market to kind of, you know, men are struggling to get their first jobs even. They're struggling to even go out. They're struggling to, like, do one semester of college. That's the data we have, is that there's a precipitous drop in male participation in even doing academics. It's very nasty, and it's just it's not talked about. There's a guy who wrote... Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Have you ever heard about this book?
Who's the author?
Nicholas Eberstadt.
I am not familiar with him.
So yeah, it's America's Invisible Crisis, Men Without Work. And it's in 2016. So he's actually talked to, I've watched some of his lectures. He's actually talked to like 50 different senators, congressmen about this issue, about the precipitous drop in male engagement and employment. And he calls it an invisible crisis. What does that tell you? That tells you that when he said that whenever he talked about this issue, he had very hard figures. He had very good data. And the thing is there would be no response to it. There'd be no care about it. There'd be like, you know, it wasn't. After he talked about, he got access to the, like, you know, the political people, but they gave no mind. And that's why he started saying that this is really invisible. You know, this million men, you know, tens of millions of men dropping out of society, of labor, really, and it being invisible, like, really tells you about the average male's value in this society, especially the younger male. So, you know, that's another just evidence piece of where we seem to be going. As we get more online, as we get towards kind of like a neo-feudalist system, and we get like a post-labor system, you know, the number one goal of the elites was to decouple themselves on being reliant on the labor of the majority, right? Because that's the only check and balance system there was, is that, hey, there's a lot more of us than there is of you. And that doesn't seem to be a check and balance that's going to be working anymore. With ramping on automation, globalization. I mean, it's hard for people to riot and get together in a union when they're doing remote work all over the world. when one guy's in Singapore, one guy's in India, one guy's in Laos, you know, that's not going to work. Automation, same thing, you know. And yeah, I mean, there's so many tangents to this, but I can move on to a different point if you'd like.
Well, I do have one observation on that point. Young men who were never working, you know, who aren't unemployed because they lost a job, who just didn't go to school and never really got a job, they don't count as unemployed in the way that, you know, unemployment is calculated. Also, guys in prison don't count as unemployed. So, you know, guys who are just online, sitting at home, not showing up in the real world, not going to school and not working, they're not a problem for politicians, and they're not a problem for the oligarchs. Those guys have taken themselves out of the picture, which is very convenient for, you know, the ownership class or the elite class. That's fine. I mean, as long as they're not going to be, you know, marching in the streets or in making a big stink or, you know, making a lot of noise about it, if they're just going to slink away and sort of wither on the vine at home and just, you know, live their lives on the internet, that's just not a problem for, you know, the political establishment. That's their desired outcome. I mean, the best outcome would be if they all just, you know, stopped eating and just died. But this is the second best outcome. You know, they just sit at home and do nothing and don't complain. That's a dream come true for the oligarch class.
And it's very interesting that in the 20th century, that would be a nightmare for the oligarch class. In the 20th century, what was the goal of the powers, let's say in World War II? It was to mobilize as many men to be participant in either the production cycle or the war cycle of your economy, right? Yep. Having a bunch of men drop out and play chess in their basements would be just, you know, catastrophic. That's it. And, you know, the policies of these 20th century, the ideological juggernauts at that time that were fighting it out, everyone, you know, sought to empower kind of male participation and also female participation, too. Let's add that into the broader economy and the war effort. And even prior to the 20th century, the goal of most elites was to increase their population by any means necessary and to expand and to keep that population fed, of course, as well. You know, because the more excess population you have, the more colonization you can do, the more you can send to fight for distant lands, the more you can conduct warfare, the more you can produce, you know, goods. You know, it's obvious. And now it's flipped in the 21st century because what do excess population produce now? It produces a bunch of unemployed people that could potentially go out and break the system. That's the thing. That's when we talk about the incel crisis and men hating women and women hating men, and there's all these bait issues that are going on. If you look at what happened during Occupy Wall Street in 2008, that was later a bit, but anyways,
it was 2011, 2012.
Yeah, so it was post 2008. What happened is after that, what you had the media do is they ramped up so many articles about critical theory, about LGBTQ, about race issues. It just, if you look at the analytics for it, it just skyrocketed. And then there's a picture like 2010 versus 2011 versus 2016. And in 2011, it's all these people, like every sign is yellow and it says, you know, put the bankers to jail, occupy Wall Street, etc. It's all in unison. And then the next one in 2016, it's a float sponsored by JP Morgan Chase, and it's an LGBTQ float, you know,
right.
And it's on the same Wall Street street. It's in the same street in New York City. And it's very telling of what happened is that Occupy Wall Street really scared the elite, into, you know, a working class uniting. And there's even participants of the original protest, you know, down in Ground Zero of where they took place that said that, yeah, we had these things, you know, we were all unison. Then there's these people that came in, university educated, and they started grabbing the megaphone and saying, you know, there's rules to this now. The rule is if you're a white type of guy, you speak last because you have the most privilege.
The progressive stack, they called it. I actually went to Zuccotti Park in 2011, so I was a witness to it firsthand. And yeah, in the early days of Occupy Wall Street, a lot of the public sector unions in New York City were participants. And then when the anarchists and, you know, the proto-woke folk showed up and said, okay, now we're doing this according to the progressive stack and, you know, white people have to sit down, men, straight men have to sit down and stand back, and we're going to privilege people of color and, you know, sexual minorities. That's when the unions, I mean, the actual organized labor, the people who actually get stuff done in the real world said, we're done. We're out. You know, y'all have fun with that. We have jobs. We can't sit here on the pavement for 3 months. You know, we needed to do something effective immediately. And the thing with, you know, the stack and the human megaphone and the all day meetings, it just it sucks up your time. I mean, the whole purpose of that style of group, group chat, except in real life, is to make sure that it proceeds as slowly as possible and nothing gets done. And, you know, people with jobs can't participate in that. You know, people who are actually in the economy, people who are workers to be organized, they have to go to work. They can't sit there on the pavement of Zuccotti Park for months on end and do nothing. And that's what that whole progressive stack, human megaphone, you know, style of interaction leads to. It leads to people sitting doing nothing and just preening about their, you know, their victimhood status.
Yeah, and it's been it's basically a subversion of the working class getting together. And the war didn't just, it's funny because this, at that time, you were a participant in this. I only got to you from like a TV screen in like high school or something. It was being played on the media. It was a big event. And what's cool, it was mostly a nonviolent event, and it wasn't riots. It was legitimate protests. Yeah, you know, anarchists come in and break some windows, sure. But for the most part, I don't remember, you know, that's because when you have left and right, that's when the Antifa shows up with their guns and Proud Boys come up with their gun. That's like, all right, someone might get shot today. But, you know, I don't remember, you know, Occupy Wall Street isn't known as, doesn't have a body count to it, doesn't have, you know, names that are, you know, it's a, you know, it was out of everything. It was a positive event in, you know, people's reaction to what was happening with the bailout packages, with the financial system at that point. And yeah, and it got subverted. It got completely subverted. And, you know, the subverted didn't just happen on the ground, which is interesting. It happened online too. Online, the working class has like zero representation. There is like all, like who owns like Washington Post now? It's Jeff Bezos. It's these type of things. And that's what happened online, is they ramped up the amount of articles about race relations, LGBTQ. It just went up, skyrocketed. It was, you know, anybody looking at the analytics now, you know, hindsight is 2020, but now we have the data set to look 10 years back. It's obvious what happened during, you know, what's going on here? And ever since then, it's been, you know, ever since 2012, I call it like the minds have been right, because everyone tells me in young people, you know, this is going to be mostly young men disenfranchised. They tell that 2012 was really like, that was kind of like the changeover, because, you know, things like Instagram and Tinder came about, which really made the gender relations really worse. And, you know, all these things, that's when, you know, 2012, that's basically when Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street was defeated, and, you know, we got a neoliberal president reelected, and we kind of just, you know, went on. So yeah, you know, it seems like the minds were right in a way when their calendar ended. It's kind of like a almost end of history. You know, we're just in a boring dystopia. But, you know, moving on to why I brought up these like critical issues is that mass shootings seem to be on the minds of many Americans right now. And we talked about, do you remember the, you know, Chad Hill from...
He goes by Chad C. Mulligan now on Substack.
Yeah, well, he had a blog called Hip Crime Vocab. Remember when he basically said that, you know, most of these incel guys seem to be really right wing, and they seem to support the people that make the situation worse for them. And, you know, being in this community, speaking to about, you know, not 1,000 quite yet, but 1,000, you know, of the men in this type of situation already, that's like the furthest from the truth. You know, the truth is somewhere in the middle. You know, it's when you put up all the voices and the rhetoric together, it might lean a bit lefty, but it's probably in the center due to all the different people. But yeah, it's definitely not a right-wing powerhouse. The figures that are detested most are like Jordan Peterson and like, what's that big, PragerU? Like those are the two, like this is ridiculous. Like so it's not, this sphere does not attack like anything from the left mainly, except like maybe the ideology. But the figures that are most attested are kind of like the traditionalists, because they're out of touch with reality. A young man cannot do what they prescribe a young man should. You know, here you're right, life's awful, but you know, you're PragerU. Just focus on you know, keeping your nose to the grindstone, and you know, it's all gonna work out. You know, espouse these Protestant ideals and just follow that, and it's all gonna, you know, the things are bad because it's just the degeneracy of the masses. You know, which isn't the case at all. So when you invited me to speak, like to provide a different narrative, what I said, you know, what was the kid's name that he took a gun to like a protest and like killed two and then injured one other? He was 17. I forgot his name.
I make a point of not learning the names of the mass shooters.
Yeah, that's a good idea, because you don't want to, you know, the more they get known, the more infamous they get, the more people try to follow with copycats. Anyways, what happened there is...
Although somebody in the chat has provided the answer, it's Kyle Rittenhouse.
Kyle Rittenhouse. Thank you, Based Bat. So, and at that time, Kyle Rittenhouse was on kind of like, he was an emblematic of kind of like the divide getting out of control between the left and right with the protest. And what I said there is, this was maybe 9 months ago, I said, you know, get ready for more of this, unfortunately. Get ready for more of this. And what have we had? 21-year-old in Atlanta, 21-year-old in Colorado, 19-year-old now. We've spoken about this issue, then the Zoom recording went its way. But then, since then, there's been a 19-year-old shooter at a FedEx facility, you know, and these are all young men. And if some of the people's investigation on this is, yeah, all these guys were critically atomized. They were romantically frustrated, you know. To take yourself out in that matter at 19 and 21, that's just, you know, that's ending your life here very brutally, very infamously, and very early on. But like right now, there's been graph came out that said what Americans must stress most about. Right now, it's number one's the pandemic, but I think mass shootings are number three. And the thing is that as males get more atomized, you know, 99% of them aren't gonna do these types of events, but there's gonna be that 1% that's gonna act out.
Oh, I'd say it's much less than 1%.
Yeah, it's even less than 1%. And this is kind of be the consequences in saying that, oh, it's an issue of them having access to these things, which, you know, most, you know, deaths of these type of weapons are only 3%. You know, it's mostly handguns death in like gang situations. That's the consequences that we're going to face for having an atomized male population. It's going to get a lot more violent. Here's, you know, gun violence has gone up by like 60% since 2014. And most of that is not mass shootings. Mass shootings in 2020 were like 546 people, I think, that got killed in a mass shooting. So
statistically irrelevant when it comes to the total number of dead.
What's increasing is, you know, a lot of violence that doesn't qualify like as a mass shooting and doesn't get, or if it does, it doesn't get a lot of viewership, but it's still driven by young men being socially atomized, family relationships going awry, you know, romantic relationships going awry. That's a big one. It's still increasing. It's still, the fact is that we are on a scale, it might not affect most people, but we are going to have to live with a more violent society. And the media is going to, you know, milk this to oblivion to remove the gun rights of the working class. That's the thing, is if we don't tackle this issue, if it's not talked about, if it's not, it doesn't have to be remedied, because this is a very hard thing to remedy. I mean, this is just we're at an unknown time and event of human psychology. You know, we still don't know the full effects of social media, rapid internet, all this stuff on the human brain yet, but it's looking that it's not good.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
What do you think of that long tangent I just put on?
I think that we've covered it in previous conversations, but in this one, we've really skipped over the effect of technology. And yeah, I think information technology, ubiquitous porn has really is really harmed young men's abilities to and their motivation, you know, to get out there and mix it up with women. And there was porn in my day, but it was on VHS tapes, you know, and not everybody had a VHS player, and most people didn't have a private place in which to watch, you know. Porn in my, you know, when I was a teenager, was magazines mostly. And, you know, they were kind of hard to come by.
Yeah, I don't watch it anymore. You know, I've taken a, you know, after finding out, like, for the second time, like, how bad this is and saying, yeah, you know, I seem to be more depressed when using this stuff. Yeah, I definitely that I think the porn usage comes because these men have been pushed out. I mean, that's the thing, is we see, you know, that's where the black pill and the incel series is about that we have hard data that proves that a woman do not want to get with most men, young women, that is. And they'd rather go LGBTQ, as we have the big data on too, than even interact with men of their peer. So that's the problem, is that men are kind of, they're kind of pushed to toxic, they're pushed to be demoralized, they're pushed to be in toxic activities, basically. And this is something that, it's a great inequality online. If you're a woman, you have all the options, you know, dating apps are 75 to 90% male. You know, if you look at any data set, they're usually 75 to 90% male, any dating app. So it's a woman's, you know, she just has pick of the litter. You know, she might complain about her options on there, but she still has options. Whereas the average guy, you don't have any options. You don't have any options to romantically fulfill yourself as a young man. And we're seeing that, you know, 51% of men, according to Pew Research, 51% of men 18 to 29 are single, while it's only like 32% for women. And it actually, like, you think it would get better for men as they get older, and it certainly doesn't. The divide actually increases the older you get, as more women get married away. So that's, you know, we talk about all these inequalities, but when it comes to the difference between young men and young women, is that there's this big romantic accessibility gap. And, you know, and now it's like the data's coming out, but then now we're being gaslit saying, oh, that's not important. And it's kind of silly at this point. And when you're like a young man stuck in this reality where you don't have something, you don't have any chance to get it, other things suck in your life, and you're just socially isolated, but you're told, you know, don't worry about that stuff. You know, it's all on you. We have a just world. You know, that drives, no wonder we're driving a small percent of men crazy to do insane things, you know? And I'm surprised this doesn't get addressed. And that's a difference, is what I see with those, an older generation that have their own podcasts, that have their own political shows, is that this is a topic that doesn't even grace, you know, that doesn't even scratch the surface or anything. But for young people, it's a big deal. Men and women, the two genders, are very antagonistic to each other now. Like MGTOW content, basically like woman's critique of men and men's critique of women has exploded in popularity online. And it seems to just be dividing a greater rift, which is just a thing for the elites to exploit. So that's the problem. I don't think that like things like pornography and video games are, I don't think men are choosing to that. They're pushed to cope with the reality. They pick these things to just cope with the reality of what they don't have.
Also, with the dating apps, you know, the like Tinder is basically just the straight version of Grindr. You know, Grindr's a gay dating app, and you know, it's a great time to be a gay man if you know if what you're looking for is casual sex, because man, the apps just deliver it right to you. But you know, that's not going to work for heterosexual pairings. That same interface is just not designed to, it's not optimized to put men and women together. And yeah, as you say, particularly men. But what's worse, I think, is that it has normalized this expectation that you're not allowed to try to approach a woman or to make a connection with a woman outside of the app. You know, and as you say, the app is where she has absolute, you know, the power imbalance is just insane on the app. And, you know, if you're not allowed to actually talk to somebody, you know, in about anything except like an exchange, like at a cash register or something, if just walking up and starting a conversation with somebody is considered harassment, well, then, you know, there goes all the motivation for polishing one's social skills. Because I'm basically, you know, an introvert. But when I was, you know, when I was in my 20s, I studied NLP. I took a speed seduction seminar with Ross Jeffries, you know, this famous speed seduction coach. And I put all that stuff to use, and I pushed it too hard and too far to the point where if I behaved today the way I did then, I would definitely be in trouble. But back then, you know, boldness was still rewarded. So I see the situation as being pretty bad. And as I've mentioned many times in the past, not on this conversation, though, I have two sons. One's 20, the other is 16, and I just don't envy them, you know, their position in history, really.
Yeah, it's a tough position to be in. Yeah, going the first thing you brought up is dating apps. Yeah, so 2008, I think Grindr came around, and in 2012, Tinder was just a straight-up copy of Grindr. The swiping apps that have, like, infiltrated, kind of like saying, like, oh, this is the way you date, which is statistically not really, but, you know, it's a system that does not, like you said, it's absolutely does not work for heterosexuality, and we see that. It's alienated the interaction between heterosexuality. It's just poisoned the well. You know, Tinder is about 10 years old now. It's not as used as much. It's become infamous, really, for, you know, young people discuss it. Tinder is now, like, an infamous thing that's kind of nasty. It's kind of gross. You know, the app store, someone just told me it's a 3-star review on App Store, that's pretty terrible. So it's known as it's actually the app that made the most revenue out of any app ever. If you look on Apple Store or something like that. So yeah, it's a very toxic platform. And the thing is that what's the alternative between these online interactions because they're a no-go for men at this point. It's we have the data, we have the big data on it. We have huge sample sizes, you know. In a documentary we made for this channel, there was it was the largest sample size I've ever seen. It was like 18 million people that this marketing agency had access to. That 18 million people, and they checked the demographics, like they discovered, whoa, Tinder's 90% male, you know, Bumble's 80% male, you know, Match is like 75% male. So it was a catastrophe on that scale for if you're a guy using these things. But going back to what you talked about, is what's the alternative is to go out in real public, real life. So I've been looking a long time on subreddits like r/dating, r/dating over 30, all these different things. Are forums that are a neutral ground for men and women to discuss their difficulties and their views on dating. And overall, it's like so common that women say, I do not want to be approached. I do not want to be approached. I'm going about my life. I'm busy. I have school. I have work. You know, women are much more engaged in academic and work than men are. They do not want to be bothered when they go out. That's why there's a term called the resting bitch face. They want to basically project that, hey, I'm not in the mood. Please don't do that. And and then when asked, you know, women do not want to meet a man through being cold approached, you know. Women want to verify that the man, you know, not a serial killer, not this, not that. There's different things they say. But overall, women do, like, that's not an option, basically, for men to conduct themselves in the public sphere to approach women. That's something that will get you, like, police called on you. That's something that will get, like, it's just a no-go in 2021, especially with the pandemic. You know, I mean, if anything, what's happening now has solidified that. But overall, young women, when they're surveyed, when they talk about their situation, they don't want to get approached. That's one of their fears. That's not how they want to conduct themselves. The strange thing is that in the past with the boomers, it's thought to be that, oh, it's the men that did the choosing. If you did end up,
it's always been the women who've done the choosing.
Yes, exactly, and it's not known, unfortunately. But I think you did the NLP course. You did like the social. You kind of know that because I was watching this NLP thing, and I was like, and I think the lecture said, you know, 80% of their interactions between romantic interaction between the woman and man are really like they're really started covertly by the woman. And I agree with that. That's how, if I ask like how most of my relationships came into play or my friends' relationships came into play, it's like the woman, they open the door and it's up to the man to go through that. They're not going to say, hey, let's go bang. Hey, let's go on a date. Let's go this. But they make it very dead obvious to a man.
Yeah, they'll show interest.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it really works. So these perversions of I need to cold approach, I need to warm approach, I need to DM, all these are perversions of like a sexuality that's not really there. And it's no wonder women are getting alienated and they're choosing to date other women, or they don't want to be cold approached. So it's a very terrible scenario, and it's a perfect scenario if you want to reduce the base amount of population. I mean, it's the first thing you got to do is not discuss it. That'd be step one. You don't want, if you have this perfect system going on, you have this, you know, you're reducing your population, you're reducing family structure, you're reducing cohesiveness of a society. You know, you have this working model. You don't want to, that's the number one thing. Step one is to not have that leak out, you know. And I think these dating apps, these social media apps, they reinforce these things. One of the things I talk about is TikTok. TikTok is a Chinese app that a lot of countries banned. India banned it a year ago. Pakistan has just banned it. And they say the same thing. It's degenerate. It produces social instability. You know, these more cohesive governments. But here, you know, Donald Trump tried to ban it and it went nowhere. You know, Microsoft immediately said, we'll buy that up from you. But, you know, the arguments they said is
that we can't let this go.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you familiar with a book called The Pentagon's Brain, an uncensored history of DARPA, America's top secret military research agency? It's by Annie Jacobson. And I know it seems a stretch, but, you know, we were talking earlier, you mentioned that in previous centuries, countries would be really, and leaders of countries would be really concerned if they thought their birth rate was low, because they knew that their rivals might have a higher birth rate, and that would lead to, you know, the military advantage shifting to the country with the higher birth rate and the more fecund population. And something that Annie Jacobson mentions in this book, and there's a good talk at Google that you can hear by her, the Pentagon is pushing really, really hard for autonomous weapon systems to develop them as quickly as possible because, you know, one, they're a heck of a lot cheaper. Like, there are already autonomous naval vessels that have no humans on them at all, and they cost like $17,000 a day, you know, to run it, whereas a ship with, you know, hundreds of actual military personnel on board costs tens of millions of dollars per day to operate. So they're cheaper. If you have, you know, say drone combat, two drones are fighting one another. If one is controlled remotely by a guy in a trailer in Nevada, and the other one is autonomous, the autonomous one, you know, there's not that slow human in the loop. It's going to have the advantage. And if you don't need a human operator for every drone, you can make lots and lots of them. And so there'll be a numerical advantage. So the Pentagon has strong motivation to push hard to take the humans out of the equation in terms of, you know, global military capability and strike capability. And so that's one more reason why you just don't need a lot of young men. You know, if women are more compliant workers, if women make better students, if women are just more useful to the rulership class in the workplace, you know, and men are troublesome, you really don't want them. I mean, if you don't need them for military service and you don't need them for heavy manual labor, if most of the labor is cognitive labor, women are better employees from the perspective of maintaining control. So, yeah, I mean, there's just strong motivation to not have so many volatile young men around.
Yeah, and what, unfortunately for elites, is human birth rates greatly favor the male. So, you know, it's like one for every young female born, it's 1.10 males, and 1.9, 1.10. In places like China, India, where they have selective births, they have a situation where they created too many men. In the United States, we actually have a male surplus of our own problem that's not really talked about at all. But it's there in a census if anybody wants to look. The thing is that, the first point you made, or the last point you made, there was a documentary in China talking about it was about automation, and there was this factory owner, and he was like, yeah, I try not to hire men anymore because of the demographic situation of China. Men are there's not a lot of women to access, and there's a lot of that's why they have a housing bubble. There's all these things going on. And he said, yeah, men are the one, they'll try to hit a woman, they'll fight each other, they're very aggressive, they're very stressed out. I don't hire men anymore. The women, they showed like a lunchroom, they're all happy, they're all kind of, they're satiated, they're not volatile as men. And he says, and he straight up said, you know, I'm trying to automate so I don't have this issue anymore. I don't have this issue where I have to deal with like young men. I don't remember what that, but you know, in China, they don't have the same kind of, they don't try to layer a cake with frosting like we do here. They're just like straight up, yeah, I don't want men here. They're too, you know, they're too volatile. And, you know, they're volatile due to, you know, China's situation. That's, you know, we have a similar situation here. On the topic of drones and war getting more move on to like the next stage of warfare, which is like drone warfare, mm-hmm. AI, all these autonomous systems. Here's the thing: is a good case study is Afghanistan. If you look at the trajectory, there's some bumps in there, but if you look at our trajectory of how we succeed, like our war in Afghanistan, basically it's progress. Who held most of the territory, everything. The more technologically advanced America got, generally, the worse the war got in terms of successes. In 2001, when the Taliban were almost wiped out, when the Americans went in with few special forces, like on horseback and like Northern Alliance, it was fully manned. In 2001, there wasn't the technology we have today. But now, in 2021, when America is basically defeated and pulling out of there, and you know, letting 5,000 Taliban prisoners go for 1,000, you know, of Afghan or national army, like it's you can tell by those numbers who really has the advantage, and the Taliban have waged a relatively low tech warfare against NATO forces, while NATO has completely ramped up at more autonomous systems, more AI, more everything, more higher end systems. And if you look at something like the Afghan papers, you'll see in the numbers that it's terrible. Our record of kill death ratios, our record of gaining ground is worse than the Soviets. I mean, it's really, you know, Afghan papers, if you guys want to look that up. And it's gotten progressively into unwinnable war. And the thing about Afghanistan, it's never been really defeated. The British Empire, the Soviet Empire, and now us have been all, it's the graveyard of empires. But if you notice, it's probably the most patriarchal country out there. It's a country that the young men, they really do have a purpose. It's not a good system at all. You know, the Taliban are very extreme. They have an extreme ideology. But still, it gives the young men there a lot of morale. Well, on some forum, I remember seeing that there was a military psychologist. He was deployed to Afghanistan, and he said, you know, the number one problem I see is that these men, they come here and they have relationships across, they have back home, and those relationships always fall apart. Almost always, like they said, like the you have like 80% chance of divorce or 80% chance of your relationship failing if you're a deployed soldier or marine or military personnel across the world. And he said, you know, these guys, they go out and then they have these problems at home they have to deal with, usually with the wife, usually losing custody of their kids. And it's like, well, how can those guys focus and not walk into a landmine? How can those guys like focus and not have like, you know, not get too angry and shoot a civilian or something? Not that that's just justified, but it's the occurrence is greater when you have a demoralized soldiering force. And I think that these elites want to bring these autonomous systems and everything, but I think like human culture and how cohesive your society is, that will win in the end. You might take more casualties or something. It might look bad, but I think Afghanistan is a great case study as to, you know, technology is not going to win war by itself. And morale is definitely, as it always was, is definitely probably the number one influencer of who's going to win, you know. And our morale has been worse and worse as the, you know, my friend in the military, he recently got out. He said, if you want to, he's like, you know, you talk about this insul stuff, but if you want to see the worst case of insul dump, go to a military base, because there's guys swiping on dating apps that are, you know, we know don't work for heterosexuals, and they're swiping at like almost nothing because they're in the middle of nowhere. And they have, you know, so they don't have any like romantic prospects or anything. It's, that's a challenging situation. It's no wonder they want to get rid of soldiering and they want to get rid of stuff like that, because yeah, with a demoralized situation at home, it's not effective to have like to project force with a bunch of men across the, you know, they might mutiny. That's not happened, but still, it's happened before in history. But yeah, I don't think that's going to be just a one and done solution. It's just automate everything. I think, you know, as we see with the Taliban, and it's basically a very good victory for them. What they have, you know, the prisoner exchange, the numbers, the casualties they're inflicting on the Afghan National Army. It's looking like we're defeated. All of NATO pulling out. So that's my perspective on it, and I take most of that from the Afghan papers that were leaked about the numbers and statistics and how everything was lied to the American public.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back, never to go its back, old dimensions. Back.
All right, that was First of Incel Maddox. Again, if you want to hear more of that conversation, there's another 2 hours, and it can be found on YouTube. There will be a link in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on crealm.com. I will also post it to my Patreon page, patreon.com/KMO. All righty, you know, one of the last things that First mentioned there is the topic of morale. Now, I know the word morale from playing war games, you know, tabletop war games in the 80s. And, you know, armies on the field of battle, they don't fight to the last man. They don't stand there and, you know, hack and slash and shoot at each other until everybody on one side is dead. At some point, one side or the other is going to lose their nerve, and they're going to stop fighting, and they're just going to try to get away. When that happens, their morale has failed. And morale doesn't always, there's not always a one-to-one correlation to your actual strength. You know, the morale for a strong unit, which could continue to fight, might be subject to factors which weaken its morale, and its morale breaks early. So what's the definition of morale? I knew what it was, you know, just from the wargaming context, but the definition is the confidence, enthusiasm, and discipline of a person or group at a particular time. And it is that morale which is referenced in the word demoralized. If something has degraded your morale, or the morale of your group, you have been demoralized. And I know that demoralized is a word that Jim Kunstler uses a lot to describe the state of the culture right now, to describe the populace. You know, if you're an oligarch, or if you work within the penumbra of the oligarchs, your morale may be quite high right now, but I think for a great many people, their morale is very low. And one of the, you know, great many reasons, I think, that the Pentagon is pushing as hard as it can to take humans out of the loop, to remove humans as a necessary component in its global strike capacity, is that robots don't have any morale. You don't have to worry about robot morale. You have to worry about them getting hacked. You have to worry about them behaving in unexpected ways. But you don't have to worry about them being demoralized. And, you know, one of the last things that First was talking about in our conversation is the morale of young men in general in this society. I mean, they go into their military experience with a very low base morale. Now, I know, some of you listening, and if you're still listening and you fall into this category, well, good on you, you know, for pushing on. Maybe, you know, your hands weren't free and it wasn't convenient to turn off the podcast, but you really disagree with this whole line of thought. Particularly if you're a woman who's my age or older, the whole idea that the power balance is tilted in favor of women these days, you know, in the younger generations, is probably just offensive to you because it is so, so contrary to your own experience as a young woman. And yet, you know, one of the things that John Ronson described quite well in his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, is that online, the balance of power shifts very quickly. And a person who was seen as a victimizer because they said something which could be characterized as something victimizers would say or oppressors would say, you know, when thousands of people that they don't know are suddenly showering them with opprobrium and disapproval, the balance has shifted. We live in a fluid world. There's a lot of people. Technology is disrupting, you know, technology has been disrupting familiar modes of living for my whole life. You know, I was born in 1968. Computers were the size of rooms when I was born, and they've been getting smaller, cheaper, and more powerful my entire life. But it seems like we don't even have time to settle into the new normal before it's disrupted. We're in a constant state of social disruption now. And our morale? I can't say it's never been lower, but in my lifetime, from my perspective, it seems as though it's never been lower. For some reason, I'm a party to a discussion, an incel discussion on Discord, and my phone chirps every time there's a new message. And I'm sure I could find a way to remove myself from that discussion, because I'm not participating in it. I am just a spectator. But a lot of the guys, you know, who are talking to one another, I mean, demoralized is just the perfect adjective to describe their psychological state. Many of them have swallowed the black pill, and they're very, very cynical. And they have no hope whatsoever. I remember, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. I was a teenager and a young adult in the 80s. And to the Gen Z guys now, I mean, I come from the land of, or the time anyway, of milk and honey. I come from that magical period, you know, when men and women got together pretty easily. And they got along better than they do now. I mean, it's always been tough, but not like now. But I remember, you know, when I think back now on my 20s, I think, well, that's the time I was having the best sex of my life and lots of it. But I also remember in those periods when I didn't have a girlfriend and I was involuntarily celibate, I was absolutely miserable. But I was never in a position where I thought, oh, I will never have sex. I will never have the opportunity to have sex. I have no experience with that sort of fatalism, that sort of, you know, just ironclad pessimism about my future prospects. I always knew that the dry spell would end. But even so, they were miserable times. And I'm not going to go on a long tangent about this, but this does relate strongly, and first was bringing this up. A country, a society with a low birth rate is essentially a society with low morale. It is not a thriving society. And across the so-called first world, and, you know, in Russia as well, birth rates are low. And you know, when young people are surveyed, they say they would like to get married, they would like to have children, but they don't think they can afford it. They don't think they don't have their own place to live. A lot of the young men don't have jobs. They would like to have, you know, they would like to engage in family formation, and they just don't think that they can. And the age at which people are starting families is going up, up, up. And I heard some a historical argument the other day, and I'm afraid I can't remember the source right now, but saying basically when family formation starts at age 28, that's when you have a revolution. There's never been a society where it got pushed beyond that. That's just not a sustainable prospect. And right now, at least in the U.S., the average age of family formation is 27. This can't continue indefinitely, but it can continue for what will seem like a subjective eternity to the people living through it. Which all kind of brings me back to what has become, you know, what has emerged as a perennial theme on the C-Realm podcast. The idea of a fast collapse was a romantic fantasy. You know, everybody suffers in the fast collapse. When in fact, the oligarchs are going to continue to do not only just fine, but they're going to continue to capture increasingly large percentages of wealth. The continual disruption of familiar modes of life through technology benefits them, and they will continue to subsidize and propagate messages, you know, cultural messages about how terrible working class people are, how the environmental crisis is because we just have too many people. We need fewer people. They need to live, you know, in urban centers and with high density. And we can't have all this, you know, cheap, ubiquitous air travel for the normal people. They just need to be locked in place. Air travel should be reserved for the elite. You know, the environmental arguments right now seem mostly cast in a way that, to the extent people take them seriously, reinforce the legitimacy of the elite and the class of opinion makers that authors like Joel Kotkin call the clerisy. You know, the mainstream corporate media, university professors, the opinion makers, you know, the people who articulate the acceptable worldview, the worldview that you are allowed to articulate if you work in a place like Facebook or Google or in a university. But, and you know, this is something else I take from Joel Kotkin, whose audiobook, what is it, The Coming Neo-Feudalism? Or the Coming Age of Neo-Feudalism, I think the title is. I was just listening or re-listening to it earlier today. And, you know, he was talking about how more and more people, as they reject the claims to legitimacy and authority of the oligarchs, are also rejecting concerns about climate catastrophe or just environmental concerns generally, because they have been so tightly coupled to the power, the privilege, and the legitimacy of the oligarchs. And, you know, for those of you who tuned into my live stream that I did on Tuesday of this past week, I was talking with Brent Ragsdale about climate issues. And Brent is very concerned with climate. And, you know, I articulated a frustrated point of view that was saying, until we get the oligarch problem taken care of, I don't think there's any productive conversation to be had about mitigating climate change. Because the only solutions they can offer up right now are the ones that further exacerbate the wealth and opportunity gap, and which cement their power and their authority. And as long as any acceptable action on climate involves the strengthening of this, you know, unofficial ruling class, I'm not interested. Not interested in having those conversations. So we got to fix the socio-political problem first. And then when we have institutions that the vast majority of people consider to be legitimate and on our collective side, then we can address these large-scale problems. But until then, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't a problem, I'm not saying it isn't an issue, but I am saying I'm not interested in talking about climate change. We're not at a place where we can meaningfully address that in a way that is just and equitable. The pandemic has illustrated so clearly they will never let a good crisis go to waste. And wow, climate change is the ultimate crisis. It is the ultimate opportunity for profit taking and for setting themselves up to be the monitors of everything we do and the ultimate rent collectors. All right. Well, I said I wasn't going to rant. That's kind of getting ranty. So I'll stop there. But those of you who like to hear me rant, I do a lot more of it on the Sea Realm Vault podcast. You can subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast through my Patreon. And I put up a lot of stuff on my Patreon page that is not behind the paywall. Anybody who goes there can look at it. Again, it's patreon.com/KMO. All right, everybody. That is all for this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.